Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of the NatCon Australia podcast. My guest today is Moira Deeming, a well-known Australian politician who's been a member of the Victorian Legislative Council, the upper house of the Parliament of Victoria, representing the Western Metropolitan Region since 2022. Moira has risen to national prominence in Australia and internationally as a result of her battle against various aspects of gender ideology. She was also involved for most of last year in a high-profile defamation trial against the then-Victorian leader who falsely accused her of being an associate of neo-Nazi sympathisers and extremists. Moira has an interesting and unconventional background for a Liberal Party representative, as she has long-standing family ties to the Labor Party. The district she represents is an area which has long been seen as a dead red area, an area where centre-right parties have little chance of success. We discuss her battle against extreme gender ideology in Australia, what she has learnt about what is driving it, how to deal with those promoting it, and why many politicians still refuse to engage with the issue, even when they privately concede they agree with her. We also touch on the political realignment occurring across the Western world, which she is well placed to comment on, given the area she represents and her background. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome Moira Deeming to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, some people I imagine tuning into this podcast will be familiar with you and your story. Others will know a little bit of it, and others will have an idea in their mind based on media reports, which may be accurate or inaccurate. In preparation for this, I reread your first maiden speech that you gave in Victorian Parliament. Perhaps it's worth just explaining, by way of introduction, the circumstances which led you to become involved in politics at all in the first place.
Okay, well done for getting all the way through that speech. Apparently it was unusually long. I had a lot to say. So basically it was just a story about how I didn't see myself as a politician. I saw myself as a teacher. And the more I paid attention to what was happening in the realm of education, in curriculum and the policies that were changing, the more I realised that I felt very convicted that it was impossible for me to do my job. It was actually impossible for me to do the one most important thing that I needed to do in my job, which was to safeguard my students. And I just couldn't believe the policies that they were bringing in, the curriculums that were, replacing the ability to disagree well with vilification of people who do disagree as bigots. They were removing child safeguards, they were bringing in these rules under anti-bullying programs, which, because they're anti-bullying programs, people wouldn't take a second glance at. Mm. But then I did take a second glance at them and found that they had all these policies that removed every single child safeguarding that I had ever known or held dear. And I knew that nobody would agree with those if they just knew what was in them.
Yeah, so many of these policies have such sweet-sounding labels, and until you actually dive into them, you don't realise how noxious they can be. Well, was there a particular tipping point where you decided as a teacher, hey, I've tried the best within the system. There has to be some sort of political change in order to really make change that I'm looking for?
Yes, I think if I felt that I had really strong representation in my own party and everywhere really, that I would have been happy for someone else to go ahead and do what I was doing so that I could go back to being a teacher. But I just ended up accidentally pulling on this thread and following this path. I resisted it at first because I just didn't think of myself as an MP. And then there was a moment, there were a few moments. One of the pivotal moments was actually, reading in the curriculum that if a male teacher identified as female and wanted to come in and take over my my shift supervising girls in the change room on swimming carnival day, which I had done many times before, every year I did it. And I was very careful to take a book and to explain to them, I'm just here in case you get bullied or if something goes wrong, otherwise I'll be giving you your privacy, and that's as a woman. Hmm. And I knew the girls wouldn't want me to let a male teacher in, They would beg me. They would have begged me, Mrs. Deeming, don't let him in. Mm. And I wouldn't have. Over my dead body would I have let a man in. And I knew from reading these policies that I would lose my job. And I thought, oh, I can't even be a teacher now until this is fixed.
And you did, and this is clear reading your speech, you did try to work within the system, right? You wrote the letters to the education bureaucrats. You wrote to the human rights, Victorian human rights bureaucrats, and there just was no meaningful change or even kind of acknowledgement that you had a point, right?
No, in fact, they were very, very careful. And so I also got onto local government council during this period. And I would ask in private about these laws, you know, because in public they were saying, that's not true. Women have still got their own change rooms. And I would think, oh, well, I'm not a lawyer. Maybe I've got this all wrong. You know, this sense of relief. And then I would go and ask them in private. And no, I was not wrong, but they wouldn't put it on the record. They refused to put it on the record. So when I was a counsellor, I persisted and pestered them and said, you need to put it in writing that none of these signs in Victoria mean anything. When you say female, male, and gender neutral, they all mean exactly the same thing. It's ridiculous. And you are going to set women up, and Muslim women who I thought of in particular for swimming sessions and things like that, you're going to set them up for a terrible and unfair shock, and for possibly being prosecuted. Because one of the times that I was asking questions, a council lawyer wrote back and said, even asking a man who is in a change room, why are you here or what are you doing here, could be incitement to discrimination. And they implied, actually, that me asking these questions live at council would get me complained about by council staff for incitement to discrimination.
Well, again, the first reaction to most people when you do mention this stuff is just disbelief. They don't think it's going on. What do you think, though, is ultimately driving this gender agenda? All right, because it wasn't around when I was in school. It wasn't even raised as an issue, and probably wasn't around when you were at school. And chatting to, you know, psychiatrist friends, it wasn't really recognized as a topic until about, you know, certainly past 2000, more like 2005, 2006, 2007. What do you think is the kind of emotional and political or other drivers behind this?
I think for different groups, it's different things. You know, there's obviously that cohort of people who are just confused, and actually when they hear transgender, what they're thinking about is intersex. Intersex being a biological condition who everybody on this planet has incredible compassion for, because that's very sad. But transgenderism is just giving everybody permission to identify however they like. And we all know that there is no such thing as a good man who ignores women's boundaries. There just is no such thing, okay? So I don't understand why people are confused about why we would be very concerned about men who say, well, I don't care if you don't want me in your change rooms when you're trying to get in and out of your clothes. I don't care if you don't want to see my body naked. I don't care about those things, because normally we were allowed to care about those things, and we were allowed to call people who wanted to do those things certain names. We were allowed to attach those desires to certain criminal intent. But all of a sudden we were the bigots. And I just thought, this is demented. How am I, a hateful person, 6 months before I wasn't, I was just a woman who doesn't want males to flash me their genitalia. You know, and I can still call the police if they do it outside a change room. Mm. But I just can't do it if they do it inside a change room.
Is it just misguided empathy that's driving it, or people that have taken advantage of that, or is it just, I mean, like you said, there are different groups that have different motivations.
But there's obviously a group that are making money out of this. There's obviously a group who are making an incredible amount of money out of this. The puberty-blocking drugs, when you look back through their history, Genevieve Buck, who runs the site Reddix, she's done incredible research. Actually, I feel heartbroken for her for the things that she has to read. It's actually pretty traumatic. But you go back through the history of these drugs, and they just sort of recycle drugs that they already know do harm. They've already tried them on, you know, different cohorts, and they did harm and they had to be withdrawn. And so they just sort of, I don't know why they keep getting re-released for a new condition when they keep on doing harm, other than money. And then there's just all kinds of different groups who profit or benefit in their own minds in different ways. So, for example, my problem with these laws is that without demonizing men, without demonizing people who have gender dysphoria, the fact is these laws, they legalize and empower and incentivize and protect predators. Okay, so regardless of transgenderism, regardless of any of that topic whatsoever at all, you're just removing all the boundaries and all the tools for which we had to prevent ourselves being attacked from predators. Before these laws, I'm so sorry, I don't know how to turn off the sound on one monitor. Before we had these laws, you know, I would have been able to call the police the minute a man stepped over the threshold into a change room, right? Now I have to wait until he puts his hands on me.
Yeah, it's like a get out of jail card for people
That's unacceptable.
There's still a divide, right? I understand the weirdos who are taking advantage of this to do things that they always wanted to do and now claim they're a woman. I at least understand that motivation. Obviously, I don't agree with it, but I get my head around why they see this as a loophole. What I struggle to understand is that there's a big divide amongst, and it's intergenerational divide amongst some women. Mm. Typically, you get people that are from the left, like Germaine Greer and Martina Navratilova and J.K. Rowling, famously, who's been a champ, right? Yeah. They're like, look, this is nonsense. How can anyone believe this nonsense? But then you get Emma Watson, you know, also from the Harry Potter kind of association with that franchise, who is, and she's representative of younger women. The polls I've seen, and you're a politician as well, shows that younger women do believe this stuff. They genuinely do believe it, that people can change their sex or the law shouldn't reflect that there are only two genders and all of the other stuff. I mean, how do you explain that?
I've got two responses to that. First of all is, as a society, we should not be led by what children believe or very, very young people, or, you know, we are supposed to be guiding young people, not the other way around. And it's not to dismiss them, but, you know, when I have watched, for example, if you've watched any of Billboard Chris's conversations or any of the innumerable conversations that people film with themselves having these discussions with young people at university or high school, or I already know that as a high school teacher I had a few of these conversations asking the kids what they thought about, they are confused. And I know for a fact, I've been contacted by many, many families that their students, that their children, you know, when as students in classrooms do feel coerced to be silent, they do feel that they're not allowed to say what they believe. There are a whole bunch of angry young women and boys out there too. And I do notice that they don't seem to find their way into the polls. And, you know, in terms of, you know, where are the Germaine Greers and things like that, they're all out there. I would say that there's this institutional capture through two means. You know, people are confused and they're coerced. So they're confused because they're in this echo chamber that has been created by anti-discrimination laws, which, for example, in Victoria, there's now a positive duty upon every single organisation. On every organisation, public and private, to prevent discrimination on the basis of protected attributes. But when you look at the fine print about how you're supposed to do that, how you're supposed to prove that you have done your positive duty, so not reactive when you get a complaint, but before anything bad happens, how do you prove that you've created this environment? It is through these endless, you know, education sessions, these endless human resources training modules or something like that, where you just have to endure and tick a box that you've gone through the motions. You have to tick that you believe these things. You have to tick that you understand these things, even if you don't understand them, even if you don't like them, even if it makes you angry. If you want to keep your job, you have to pretend to go along with them.
Yeah, I think those on the centre-right are fond of saying that politics is downstream from the culture, you know, and we need to change the culture and then that will change the politics. And what they simply don't get is that if you change the law, you change the culture. You can dramatically change the culture. You know, I mean, and this is borne out. And HR ladies and men or whoever they are in charge of that are obliged to take seriously legal risk. And so they react and then they implement these policies at a departmental level or a private sector level. And so even if they privately don't believe it, then, you know,
the law is the law. Yeah. You can't fight the law at that level. And I totally agree with you. You know, I come from the left and I find it amusing, actually, that there's no acknowledgement of the difference between laws that, especially in the right, because I think of us as the, you know, the party that promotes freedom and reasonableness and balancing rights rather than just having a wholesale open slather of, I don't know, vicious, you know, a vicious meritocracy where it's like survival of the fittest and and like oppressive communistic socialism. You know, I think of us as the reasonable centre. And, you know, laws can either match up and balance rights and culture can guide itself, or they can be oppressive. And the laws that we have are oppressing the genuine grassroots culture that we actually have. Nobody asked for these laws. People voted for gay marriage. They did not vote for women to suddenly not exist and for child safeguards to suddenly not exist. That was not what we bargained for. That was not the vote that we thought we were taking. You know, and like, but that's what we've been lumped with. And the idea of confusion, you know, it's that classic, you know, they're very good at lumping in one concept with another. So, you know, LGB, and then they lumped in T. And even the LGB community is saying, we don't want that tea anymore. We don't want it. Like, this is, you know, because you're not allowed to be homosexual anymore. I find this, you know, again, another layer of the gaslighting and the absurdity, which is actually, you know, political oppression. You know, this gaslighting is very serious for it to be legal. But you can't be homosexual because that is based on a biological attraction based on sex. And if sex isn't allowed to be a basis for categorizing anything anymore, then you can't even be homosexual. You have to be gender attracted, or you have to reject the idea of biological sex, and you have to categorize men as women and women as men, which none of it makes sense.
It's that's right. I mean, there've certainly been some very brave men and women from the same-sex attracted community who recognize the dangers of this and have spoken out, although not all, you know, there's plenty of within that community who do support this. So within, you know, you're a member of the Liberal Party, although you do come from recognize some similarities in your history to my own, you know, old Catholic Labor who eventually moved
in.
But I think I have a reasonable sort of idea of what Liberal Party members think, both in Queensland and in Victoria and Australia wide. And I would say that, look, 90% of those at least would agree with you, right?
Yes.
So why do you think, and I actually think a lot of the elected representatives agree with you as well, but why don't they have the courage to just speak? What's stopping them?
Yeah, I've been really thinking hard about this one for a long time, because the amount of people who come and tell me that they agree with me in secret is staggering.
And these are elected reps, right?
Yes, and the MPs. I've been on both sides, Labor MPs, Greens MPs. You wouldn't believe the amount of things that I've got. You wouldn't believe it. It's amazing. I actually really am grateful that they've been honest with me like that when they're from other parties. So this fight is going on in every party. That's the one thing, the other thing that I would like to get across. They like to make it sound as though this is an issue in right-wing parties because it's such a right-wing view, which is absurd, of course. Biological reality is not the purview of any one political leaning. And, you know, parents, women, lesbians, gay men, ordinary people everywhere in all parties are just outraged at this, obviously. And the battle's going on. You just can't see it in the other parties, but it's there. In our party, in the Liberal Party, the thing that I've noticed that I think is different is that when we have a disagreement, or if there's a hot topic that we don't quite know how to deal with, or we've tried to deal with in the past and it didn't quite work, and so they never want to touch it again, even though in the background momentum's building for support for that original position that they took. It's like they give up early. The left never give up. They take one more meter, you can push them back a kilometre, keep coming. Like that is the attitude that we need. And also they get organised. So I've noticed, and this is my point of view, I can't prove this, but I feel as though to mount any kind of a campaign, you need to get organised and you need to agree on your messaging and things like that. And I don't think that our party has had a serious conversation about this issue or even about something like abortion. So they say, oh, we've got freedom of conscience. I'm like, that's great, but what are we actually going to say? Because I keep seeing factions, like, you know, there'll be one faction that'll say something about it and the other faction will feel like they have to pop up and say, no, we're not going to talk about that. That's not a topic we're going to talk about. And I just think we needed to have a discussion privately inside and say, right, we've got people who are pro and against. We don't know to what extent. We don't even know what these pro-lifers would even be willing to support. They might not be as extreme as, you know, I'm imagining, or who knows, but there's no actual internal conversation where we're hashing it out and saying, look, this is going to be our line together. I don't want to see anybody popping up in a newspaper saying, you know, like attacking our own members. We constantly do that, and I do not see that from Labor. But we constantly do that. Because we're not coordinating inside, we're not planning, we're not agreeing on things. Because, you know, we've got a shadow cabinet and they get to agree on all the policies and things. And it's like, what about the members? And what about the rest of the MPs?
There's something I've reflected on this too. The DNA of Labor stresses solidarity, but it also, because they came from like union background, they're up for a fight, right? Whereas the Liberal Party members were the nice middle class and decorum was important and let's sort of like make sure everyone is, you know, not, I don't know, ruffling things up too much. But at the same time, there have been debates within the Liberal Party and the centre-right on different things. And I just feel like in recent times, they've given up the ability, they've lacked the confidence in their ability to persuade both their own members and the broader public. Like, they don't relish a debate. They focus on PR above everything else. And PR is transitory. It comes, you know, you can have good PR one day and bad PR another, but the debate is much more substantial and enduring, right? So why avoid it?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think it's a matter of conviction. And I think if you don't have actual conviction, if you don't look at the Liberal Party's set of values, if you don't look at our economic philosophy, and if you don't know deep down in your toes, like just deep down, that if we do not push this economic philosophy in Australia, people are going to suffer, things will go wrong. And people and families will really suffer. There'll be genuine suffering. If we do not do something, people are going to suffer. And if we don't believe that and want to help, then I don't know, we're just going to look at opinion polls and I don't know, we're going to be led around by the nose by Labor and Socialists and Greens and opinion polls. And it's like, no, if we know that it's true and we are right, well, we need to get out there, make a plan, campaign, bring in a big group of people under one tent and just consistently go forward. But also I do see some pretty good focused fighting sometimes. Like I was shocked. I was really shocked at how I was made into an example of something bad to fight and fought against. Like I was, right, by my own.
Yeah. Oh, it was amazing.
I was pretty astounded at that it was directed at me instead of the opposing team. So it's not, I don't know that it's that they can't do it. I don't know. I don't know what they thought. I don't know who they thought that I was. I don't even, because I was confused.
Yeah, I mean, it's just for anyone just coming into this blind, you know, you got accused of being a Nazi, right? essentially, or associated. Legal language, right? But associated or somehow having. Yeah, that's right. So you don't seem like a Nazi, you know, and yet they just that was a line that Dan Andrews, the former Premier, kind of ran and used it as a basis for attacking the other side. But the Liberal Party kind of accepted that argument might be true and then went into damage control mode. Is that what happened? I mean, is that
I mean, I'm not, you know, I can't actually ever get into their minds.
Yeah.
But, you know, Daniel Andrews was very careful with what he said. He never ever said anything as clear as what was said by the government side.
Of course, interesting.
Yeah, so it was like he's very good. He's very clever. He's had very good training, has Daniel Andrews, about how to smear people without being legally liable. He doesn't say people's names on purpose. People think that's him just being sexist. No, no. That is him being a Machiavellian. I'm sure he's a sexist in some ways. I mean, that's what it looks like. I mean, so many of the victims were women. Makes you wonder. But what I really think is that he was just incredibly Machiavellian, and he was good at being awful and getting away with it. You know, that's a bit of an aside, but the point is we can fight. We just need to be united. We need to have our ideological arguments inside the party, and we really need to have them properly, because whining each other through the media is just a waste of everybody's time. You know, we're put in here, we're paid a pretty good wage, we're entrusted by all these membership, you know, the members, people out there. Well, I feel really, really sorry for, because what happened to me is happening to them all, and they're invisible. They're totally invisible.
Like you said, this is quite frustrating, because people are given, you know, public funds as elected representatives, and you have the right in Parliament to be able to speak under parliamentary privilege and raise, you know, matters without risk of defamation actions. And yet many, many others out in the outside of that, which don't have those rights because they're subject to corporate policies or legal risks, they don't have the ability to speak. So that's, you know, it's incumbent upon those who are elected or fortunate enough to have that role to be able to talk on these issues. What do you say to people, the argument, though, that, look, it's cost of living, we don't want to talk about, we need to focus on that alone, and any of this other stuff is not an ultimate vote winner, therefore it's a distraction. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with this kind of line, distraction. Yes, we'll do something once we get into government, maybe. But for now, cost of living, cost of living, cost of living.
I think cost of living and crime are the number, you know, they're the top two issues. I agree with you in terms of what's really crushing people. Mm. And they are crushed. It is just terrible. And that's the other thing that I do agree with about the Liberal Party. You know, economics is not, it's not a cold, an emotional issue. You know, economics is family life. Marriages break down in economic, you know, times of economic hardship. You know, marriages break down. Terrible things happen to people through economics. It's not theoretical. I think it's a moral issue. I think it's completely moral. It is immoral what Labor has done. It is totally immoral, and they have crushed the working class. They've abandoned, exploited, and crushed the working class with their ridiculous, awful economic policies, right? Mm. But if you look, for example, at America, I was very curious when I was watching that election, because, again, coming from the left, I looked at how he brought in all these people who were in the other party. And I thought, that's what I've been saying. The people in the other party are not far left. They're centre-right. And about a month ago, you know, Cos Samaras, the pollster, he brought out this research that said that most voters in Victoria perceive Labor as a centrist or centre-right party. So all this rhetoric that I think people roll out in the Liberal Party about how Victoria is a left-wing state. I'm like, no, they're not. I come from them. None of my values have changed. I just didn't realize I was in an actual communist party. They don't tell their voters that. They don't say that. They lie to their own voters and their own members. You know, and that's voters think of themselves as centre-right. They don't think of themselves as very far left, but they think that Labor is centre-right and that the Liberal Party is a little bit too far to the right.
Yeah,
because we're not teaching them who Labor are, and we're not standing our ground firmly and showing them who we are. We're not showing them that we are the party of the centre-right, and they are, as with all far-left, you know, ideologies like communism, they only end in one direction, which is total statism. You know, the reason we are in this total crisis is not because they mismanage money. It's because of their ideology. It's because that was always going to happen, because that is their economic philosophy. It was always going to end in economic disaster and absolute trauma for families. And here we are.
I'm recording this on a day when in Queensland they've just released the mid-year financial statements, and it's been revealed we are now ahead of Victoria in terms of like debt. So, hooray.
Really? Wow, that's an effort. That is quite the achievement. Wow.
That's right. And it was referenced on the front page of the Courier Mail, the major broadsheet here, that, you know, it's we're beating Dan's Victoria, something along those lines, which I always take objection to given, you know, my first name. It's like Premier Andrews. That's right. What have you found, Maura? And you represent, for those who aren't in Victoria, the area you represent is western suburbs, suburban Melbourne, right? Quite a large area, quite a diverse area, certainly not, you know, blue blood, blue ribbon.
It's called dead red. It's called the dead red. Okay, these are dead red seats. This is called like the red wall.
Yeah.
Labor, like it is protecting them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're good people. They're really good people. They love their families. They work really, really hard. They want a better future for their children and sacrifice for their children. They're all about children and community. They're just trying to get through their family life. This cohort is exactly like me, around about my age. They've got kids like me. We're worried about fuel prices. We're worried about wasting 2 hours of our life every morning and afternoon in the traffic so we don't see our kids. Mm. You know, they've just like sucked the joy out of life with all these crushing, badly managed. I resist saying that, you know, deliberately, exploitatively, run into the ground areas of life.
You would think, Maura, that like in the UK, where the Conservatives were in the post-Brexit election able to capture these really dead red areas, like Tony Blair's old seat and places that haven't voted Conservative ever, and like Trump did in the United States, capturing these blue Democrat seats, you would think we'd be able to do that in Australia, I mean, with the right policy. Or you think the tide would be coming in these areas. What do the centre-right have to do differently here to capture those areas?
So I think we need to be prepared for when we govern. I think we're always unprepared for how the real zealots, the most ideological zealots of all time are actually in the public service. They're at the top of the departments. And they're almost like, you know, that shadowy, they're almost like a shadow government. You know, we are run. I noticed that in our legislation, a few things that I started noticing when I became an MP and, you know, a little bit before when I was actually reading legislation for the first time in my life, I would notice that there's not much detail, right? Because I was down the other end reading policies and thinking, how are these justified? How are these legal? This is insane. Mm-hmm. How is it legal? And a lot of legislation is almost like a blank check. There's not much detail. And then it's up to these public bureaucrats to fill in this, essentially this blank check.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is ambiguous, someone would have to pay the time and money and effort to go to court to challenge it and have a judge interpret it. You know what I mean? Whereas I like you, I think a lot of these things can be restrained and fixed very quickly with clear legislation. You have to restrain the public service. You can't just fire them all, of course, but you need to restrain them, and they need to be restrained by very clear legislation. They must never be given a blank check. There must be principles, that they are accountable for, you know, to uphold and things like that. So one of my other passions is actually just really good governance, just basic good governance. I've been working with a few other people about, you know, what are the legislative issues that are holding us back? You know, why isn't there accountability? You know, I put in a proposal on the crossbench about reversing the onus for freedom of information so that everything is open and everybody who wants to make something inaccessible to the public, they have to pay money and jump through hoops and spend their time and their effort and their money to justify withholding that information from the public. Otherwise, everything should be public.
Mm.
You know, it should be, the narrative should be reversed.
Mm.
Whereas I won't even bore you with like the unbelievable amount of power all these public departments and the government has to just say, well, we've decided we don't want to give that information.
No, it's the same. Obviously, it's the same in Queensland and probably more so at the federal level as well. We have, just moving back to the gender stuff, I mean, we actually have taken the centre-right have taken government in Queensland. I think we're actually the largest, outside the United States, we're the largest Anglo jurisdiction in the world with a centre-right government, which really? Is kind of amazing to behold. But we are in charge, and yet the bureaucrats on the gender stuff are still running the show. We have the capacity to change, you know, to outlaw puberty blockers like the CAS review recommends in the UK, and the UK Labour Party have said that, well, they will do, change all the definitions on the ID stuff that you're battling with, change all the laws. We haven't done that yet. And unlike, you know, the Trump election, and where it just seems as though they were ready to go this time with personnel, with policy, with legal.
Yeah, he learned his lesson. Yeah. He built a broad coalition. He got reasonable people from other parties. He made sure that he had a plan to deal with the bureaucracy. He made sure, you know, and he learned his lessons. You know, he didn't waste his time out of office. And I think that's fantastic. Because like I said, it takes planning. I think we haven't been doing the planning. We've been having this emotional reaction. We've been getting scared of the polls. We've been getting scared. You know, I've noticed that once you get power, it's almost like the public disappear and the race to, you know, this urge to hold on to that power seems to take over. I keep on telling myself, you know, you don't get stronger by giving into weakness. You know, if I imagine that I will grow a spine later if I just stay quiet, if I go against my conscience here, if I can just stay in power, that's the most important thing, because then I can get something done later. I just think to myself, that's such a lie. I'll only become weaker. Like, that's one of those lies that people tell themselves. That's just not true. And the truth costs, you know, the truth is what it is. You know, you look back throughout history, you look at the people who were your heroes, who stood up for things, and the advice that they always have is, you know, it's really not worth lying unless you're doing something like Oscar Schindler. Then you would lie with all the children. I'm all in for lying.
You can be shrewd and canny in politics, but I do think, and this has been clear with your ordeal, that courage is contagious, but cowardice is also contagious as well. You constantly kind of negotiate against yourself. I see it across the board where people, they think, oh, I won't say that, even though I believe it. And suddenly they're not saying anything and they've been conditioned themselves.
They say the opposite. And then before they know it, they're saying the opposite. So the other thing is that people don't know about me is that I did offer to the former leadership to be quiet on this issue for 12 months. I asked for advice about how to go about advocating for this issue without creating a huge headache for the team. I said, you give me a list about what, because I wanted to persuade them. I wanted to persuade them that it was a vote winner, because I know, and I knew that it is. Like, I knew it then, I know it now. Now we can also, it's just literally it's helped transform America. I didn't finish my point before, but, you know, there's cost of living, there's crime, and people want, they just, I noticed that the mainstream media and lots of people didn't want to go further down that list, because number 3 and 4 in all those seats was this issue. Right? It was. So I fully accept that the one and number 1 and 2, cost of living, crime. I get it.
Yeah,
that's true. But this is an important issue. And if Labor hadn't run us so far into the ground economically, I think this would be number 1.
That's what I mean. You can walk and chew gum at the same time, as the old expression goes. You can see that.
And so I wanted to persuade them. Tell me what you would need to feel confident in running a campaign. I will go out and I'll fundraise, I'll do research. Name it, no caveats. Give me your list and I'll go away and I'll quietly work on that for 12 months, because I get it. I get it that you have to run a soft campaign. I get it that you have to bring in a coalition of people. You have to be prepared for counter narratives. You have to get buy-in from the team. I'm all on board with that. So I get it about being canny. Like, I've spent, you know, before I got into Parliament, I spent the 10, 15 years before that networking around with LGBT groups, with people on the left, like just quietly trying, just offering help where I could, building up relationships. And then when I was thrown, you know, to the wolves, they came out for me, you know, which was so beautiful. And I was so grateful to them because it did cost them. It did cost them to stand up for me.
Yeah. You know? No, it's very interesting who does stand up when the chips are down. And you know, some people disappoint you, some people impress you, you know. What do you think generally about what has gone wrong in Victoria? Because it used to be, you know, the famous jewel in the crown of the Liberal Party. And now it's, well, it's called what, in Massachusetts, you know, by of the South. So what explains that? I mean, is it simply poor performance or are there other factors at play which have led in this direction?
Yeah. Like, coming from Labor, the whole time I've been listening to the Liberal Party say, and you know, people like Costamaris before he released his research contradicting himself. Now, listen to people say that, you know, Victoria is the most progressive state. They're progressive in Victoria. They have one-shot type in Victoria. And I was thinking, the group that you're talking about raised me. They taught me how to campaign. I am literally their creation. I have all the values that they have. I know how their machine works. I think about political campaigning the way they taught me to. And the Liberal Party is believing one of Labor's campaign lies about how we're so progressive. Because I was like, they're not. They're literally mums and dads, tradies, workers. The only group of them that aren't are these very high-up, hoity-toity union bosses who are the equivalent of the Canberra bubble. And we all saw how the Canberra bubble didn't represent the rest of Australia in the no, you know, in the voice vote. So. I mean, that's what I think. I listen to that and I'm like, but that was just one of their lines. That was just a classic, hilarious line by Labor, which then the Liberal Party picked up and started regurgitating all by themselves.
I read somewhere that almost now 50% or close to it members of the Victorian Liberal Party live in the seat of Kooyong, which is now represented by Atiyah. I don't know whether that's true or not. I think it'll be something like that. It's similar in other capital cities of Australia. The donors, the Liberal Party, old-time Liberal Party members, the branch network, all exist in the inner city still compared to the outer city, which is where supposedly the tide comes in. And it's a different culture, right? They do go to work at BHP. They do hang out with teal types and they do talk, you know, they talk in a very different way to the outer suburbs and regional towns in Australia. And I'm with you. I just think, I grew up in regional towns, I just think that that gender issue is actually an enormous vulnerability for Labor in those seats, because I don't think that's what they might think that in the inner cities. I don't think that's what they think in the outer burbs. Right?
I've had an interesting, you know, life in terms of, I've actually also come from that elite group of Labor, to be honest, like Chardonnay, Swilling, Labor, like they were Labor, right, but they were all about big government because they think that big government is, you know, what will look after families and vulnerable people. You know, they went, it was a weird amalgam of the two without really understanding it. And, you know, they're feminists, all right? The minute this came out, I was like, oh, that's not going to last. The most politically savage, the most organized, the most relentless group of people in Labor are the women, and strongest union is like the nursing union. Apart from the building unions, like, it's the nurses. All right, and they are not going to put up with that. In fact, a lot of them, a little bit, no offense, are a little bit so, you know, they don't like men, you know, but there's a little bit of that.
They're not going to put up with what, Laura? They're not going to put up with
going to put up with being told by men and anybody that men can do whatever they like, that men can come in, that as a nurse, that they can be, as a patient, you know, that their patients have to put up with a male nurse doing, I don't know, an intimate examination on them. Like, they love people. You know, they're good people. They love their patients. Like, teachers love our students. Like, we have safeguards. We're nurturers, right? But also the unionists, you know, they're feminists. Like, they always talk about the patriarchy. I grew up hearing about the patriarchy. And I was like, I never believed in the patriarchy, to be brutally honest, until this transgender issue. Because I was like, why is this man's opinion and his desire to feel welcome in public and to participate more important than all these women? Why?
But is it really the guys that, because like I said before with the Emma Watson and the young people example, it always strikes me that and the polls that I've seen say that men in the broad, both young and old, just aren't really buying the gender stuff. But the big cohort that do, for example, are the younger women predominantly. But we had a minister for women in Queensland, Shannon Fentiman, who you may have heard of, who couldn't find it, right? So she would proudly, you know, walk around, I'm feminist, this feminist, that. I mean, and I think at one level she does believe that nonsense and is committed to it and thinks anyone who disagrees with you and others is, you know, some sort of like beyond the pale crazy. So, and I'm sure there'll be people in the Nurses Union Victoria not unlike her, right?
Yeah. I just got the impression that in Labor, because they've abandoned meritocracy to a certain extent with their gender quotas, that they've got a whole bunch of tokenistic females who got all the way there by doing exactly what, you know, just regurgitating whatever they're told to regurgitate. I do agree with you, but what I'm saying about with the men is that the ones who don't agree with this, so there's this huge cohort that don't. And when I say, you know, bow down to what men want, I'm talking about those men who have demanded access.
Oh yeah, the weirdos.
Or even, you know, I do agree that there's such a thing as gender dysphoria. Like I feel that there's a whole bunch of ordinary gay men who are very confused, and you know, you see them in grief after they've had these surgeries. You know, like it's heartbreaking. These poor guys.
Yeah.
Anyway, so like this is what I mean about there's all these different groups. There's all sorts of different things going on. But just in terms of campaigning, I saw right from the beginning that feminists eventually would work out that this is prioritising men's desires over females' desires, and they do not, as a rule, really do that. Like, rightly or wrongly, I just thought, ooh, none of the feminists I know are going to roll over and let that happen. That's just like that's.
But why haven't Mamma Mia being an ally for you or the, you know, the women's forum, you know, I know there are a lot that have, but there are plenty that haven't, right?
Like, I think it's government funding. I think it comes back to the way that in Victoria, this is the other point. So, you know, at its base, we're centre right. However, like we said, they have created this top-down culture. They pushed it down all the way down to the grassroots using legislation, coercive, punitive legislation. Creating and paying for all these positions to create this echo chamber where everyone says the same thing. And if you don't tick these boxes, you literally don't qualify for government funding. You literally are at risk of losing your license. There are schools that are at risk of losing their license to operate as a school because they do not want to put up even religious schools. There's no religious caveat. People don't know that. And it shouldn't be a religious freedom to believe in a biological reality. That's ridiculous. So I'm not going down that path. I don't think they need a special right and that no one else can believe in biological reality. But, you know, you can lose your license. You think about in COVID, the same thing happened. You know, there were doctors losing their licenses who just genuinely just using all of their expertise, they just thought, oh, I don't agree with this. I don't think on my, you know, the basis of my conscience that I can promote this. They lost their licenses.
There are very powerful tool that they have to silence the professional association. I mean, your friend and mine, Gillian Spencer, stood down still now, almost like 18 whatever months later, for simply having a genuine, conscientious, scientific objection to the stuff that she saw in that clinic. And she is not a culture warrior from Central Casting. She is just
I was a culture warrior before the random teacher. I had no, like, I didn't run my views in my classroom. I did. No, but like, they didn't know my, like, they knew if they asked, but I was very gentle. And I always checked with my kids, who do you think I vote for? They never knew.
Yeah.
Until I ran.
In the UK, I mean, the US now with a new president have are just turning tables on this sort of stuff. It's going to, I mean, and that will have an influence. Executive order day one, men can't be women, women can't be men. I mean, it's just glorious to see it in print, in writing, right?
Isn't it?
It's sort of unbelievable. I, who knew politics could do that? Who knew, you know, you could actually...
Stop giving up. Keep going.
I found the guys in the UK, women in particular, have been very effective under similar circumstance, legal regime that we have in Victoria and Australia at making the case and getting through. Is that the case? Are they better than we are? And if what have they done that, that women in Australia haven't been able to do as effectively yet?
So I went on my tour of Turf Island back when I was first expelled. And that was literally what I wanted to find out. How come they have been so successful in the UK? And I did some more research afterwards in America. And so that basically in the UK, their laws are challenged all the time. So they have a bunch of left-wing lawyers who pro bono take calls, cases all the way through. So they crowdfund it or they get someone to fund it. We don't have we just don't seem to have that kind of
infrastructure or ecosystem.
It's like a pattern of behavior. They know that you challenge it immediately through the law.
Yeah.
You just challenge immediately. You challenge that in the law. Whereas even me, right? I could probably have challenged these laws as a teacher through the law. And said, you are putting me in a position where I have to lie to parents and it should be, and without a court order, which I still to this day think that's surely illegal. Surely I could have gone the law. But I didn't think of that at the time. I went slowly. I wrote to my MPs, I wrote articles, but they go straight to the law. You know, I've got a scholarship in the law. I should have finished my law degree. But, you know, they do lawfare. We do not do lawfare. We need to do lawfare. And we need to do it fast. We need to act quickly. So I can understand that a few things have been changed. Like we get taken to tribunals, the people who are victimized. So you think about, Lyle Shelton's been taken.
We have some lawfare here, and we have that Tickle v. Giggle.
Yeah, for our judges, this is right. So, yeah.
We have Gillian who's taking her cases, and that it's an effective tool, I think, as a lawyer, speaking as a lawyer, but it's just one tool. And needs to be kind of multifaceted because,
they have better laws than there too. So they were able to appeal to different things. So, for example, the anti-vilification legislation is coming up in Victoria and I was still on the crossbench and I was getting all of my, I was basically going to have a series of amendments that I was going to put forward. I haven't discussed it with the party yet. That's sort of been paused. But, you know, when I was reading through this, I was actually feeling conflicted because I was thinking one of the reasons that it was so great for everybody when I won was because people don't really get wins like that in Victoria, and it's because it's expensive and you have to wait for it. Like, they've really tied up all the loose ends in Victoria. They've done – the other side have really gotten themselves organised, whereas in the UK there were clearer principles that they could appeal to, and they just had a few other things that they could appeal to in the law. So you think about – now we've got this Human Rights Commission and we've got – you know, we've got Very Up in Victoria and all, like these commissions, I just feel like throwing them in the bin. Well, I don't even know why they're involved. Get out of the way. I want a real court with real law and that's all I want.
The biggest travesty was the Human Rights Commission appearing at amicus curiae in the Giggle v. Tickle case, arguing against them. I mean, what are you on?
Why do you exist? Why are you here? With taxpayer-funded dollars interfering in a case, I just feel that it's incredibly odd and biased and, like, that's my taxpayer-funded dollars advocating for something that I don't agree with. I don't know, I just don't like – the more I look into tribunals and things like that and conditions, the more I am very sus about it. But also when I was reading this anti-vilification legislation, I thought I was vilified. And I look at this law and I think, I don't want other people to be vilified. And so I have a real sympathy for it. Because it's almost like the most sympathetic thing I could say about it is, if I wanted to look at it, you know, like in the best light that I'm able to look at it, it's making, it seems to be an attempt to make defending yourself against defamation cheaper. Right? And obviously they've only got their favorite categories, and obviously it's a terrible piece of legislation. Oh my goodness, got the word probably in it a few times. I'm like, I don't want a piece of legislation with the word probably in it. No, thank you. Whatever we're doing, let's be clear. Again, because I look at that and I'm like, that's that blank check for those crazy public servants and those judges who can interpret however they want. I don't want any of that. So look, it was very expensive. Like my legal bills are like $3 million. If it wasn't for extremely generous people, I just would not have had a chance to clear my name. My children would be forever smeared as being the daughter of basically a Nazi. You know, I would never have court again if they ruined my political career. I still wouldn't have been able to go and teach. I mean, it was just going to ruin my whole life. And it does happen to people elsewhere. They're not pathetic and worthless for not standing up to this, all these people. Like, they're going to lose and have no avenue of justice. They're totally oppressed. And so that's why they loved seeing that I won. But it was so expensive. I remember the moment that I got the next tranche of money, or the bill, I think, and the money to pay it from, you know, like on loan from this lovely man. Like, and it was worth more than everything my husband and I owned together in the world. And we don't own everything. It's all like mortgage. And it was just a really horrible moment because I thought nobody can get justice in this state.
No. And that's why, and there are plenty of, you know, you're high profile, you're an elected representative, but there are thousands and thousands of people who just can't contest. And you know, this business about, oh, you've just got to speak up. Yeah, you do. But
they have to.
that's right. You know, a few last questions because I know I've kept you a while. But in the UK, you said they engage in lawfare more than we do. We've done a bit of that. You know, they have a lot more newspapers, although they're all dying over there, like they are everywhere. And they make their case with very articulate sort of op-eds and the like. And then they do protests. I mean, and you did all those things, right? And the protest was why you got into trouble. So I almost feel like it's not as though we haven't exhausted all the options here in Australia on these points. It's just,
I should have been more specific. I think it's the left wing over there.
Yeah. Okay.
Like the left wing are extraordinarily organized. You know, these were feminists almost every single time in the beginning. It was feminist lecturers being fired and then feminists rallying around them, raising money, pursuing a court case, and nobody could call them. I mean, of course, they did call them far right, but it was ridiculous because.
This is Catherine Stock.
Catherine Stock, Maria Forstatter. I mean, their lawyers were like, like famous lesbian left wing lawyers. You know, like these are. Phenomenally, irrefutably left wing women, and in Australia, I think, you know, the Labor Party has really gone far further in silencing dissent. They've been far more captured, I think. I mean, I can't be sure. I don't. This is just me trying to look from the outside, but you know, they're very good at getting organised.
This issue would die tomorrow if Julia Gillard, our prime minister, first female prime minister, got up and said, "Hey, you know, had a think about it all, and these laws are crazy. And now I fully understand the full import of inserting gender into this, the discrimination laws in Parliament. We really need to rethink this, because then there'd be all the rusted on tops would be, hey, Julia, you know, yeah, we need to think about it. The air's changing. It's let's do this, right? But it hasn't happened. We're waiting for the kind of for that great, you know, misogyny speech, Mark II, to come out and explain why this needs to change. It hasn't happened. Final question, Maura. I think that the media landscape does affect the issues that are being discussed. And as politicians, people are trained to sort of do these like set piece, 5-minute grabs, and then you get a hostile questions, and it's typically the question that the journo asked that is put in the news that night. Gotcha, you know, gotcha moment. Yeah. But there's been a dramatic change in the media landscape over the last couple of years. And famously, in the US presidential election, it was the long-form interviews with Joe Rogan and others that actually gave people a much more interesting view into the personalities of people like a J.D. Vance or a Elon Musk or a Vivek Ramaswamy and Donald Trump himself, right? And if you have someone for 3 hours long, they've got to be interesting enough to say things for that period of time. And I'm not going to keep it that long, rest assured. But it also gives you, they can't, in a way, it's less risky than the set piece because people can just say, oh, well, he said that there, but yeah, he qualified later on and he was talking about that, whereas the set piece actually makes people vulnerable. And the only, this is a very long question, but the only example I can think of recently where I've seen these three-hour interrogations, podcast-like interrogations, was actually in your defamation case in Victoria, where you had people sit on the stands for 3 hours and give them the kind of like the Joe, well, it wasn't quite the Joe Rogan treatment, but it was that type of thing. You did see people's personality come through. You did see the issues fully canvassed and discussed in much more nuance than you would get in a, you know, even a Sky News quick interview.
Yeah.
So do you think, I mean, is that something we should get into going forward and get all different personalities from the center right or those that have come from left like yourself to sort of sit down at length and just let it all hang out in a way rather than being so nervous to engage and worried that anything that they have to say that might be slightly different could be labeled a gaffe?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that came out in my trial was just how poor the reach is of mainstream media. It was hilarious. I mean, that reduced my identity, whatever. And I think you could see the difference between, you know, what I noticed was as much as John was unbelievably polished and clever in the way that he answered his questions, the lawyers were frustrated, even the judge was frustrated, people watching on were frustrated. But he is unbelievably polished, and then I was not polished. I was just completely honest. I didn't look good all the time, and but it was very clear that I wasn't trying to manage, you know, to manage it to get rid of gaffes. I don't know. I was completely vulnerable. I was completely honest, and I just had to deal, like, it was, the truth was the truth. That was it. I wasn't trying to avoid answering anything. You know, I did notice that, in my opinion, that lawyer was after a gotcha question. You know, he opened on the issue of safe schools. My best friend was watching at home, you know, doing the dishes with her baby in the background, and she was really worried for me, obviously. I was so nervous. I was just, I didn't want to cry. I did not want to cry on the stand. That was like my one goal. My one goal was just not to cry on the stand. And he opened with this topic, and she, you know, my friend told me later that she started laughing because she was like, if there is one topic that you just forget yourself when you completely right because you are in your zone, it is child safeguarding. And that, like, he had no chance to make you fall. He had no chance to make you hesitate. You know what you believe, you know why you believe it, and you're not ashamed of it. And, you know, a few times he said, oh, well, very well said, Mrs. Deeming. And in my head I was thinking, what did you think that I believed?
Well, this is the thing, right? Like, the press is still, some of the mainstream press in Australia is still describing you as an anti-trans activist, even after all this. Like,
I have put in so many complaints. I'm going after that. I'm going after that issue. I will not. Ready? This is the next hill I will die on.
Great. Go battle.
All the way to the end. I'm going there.
And are you holding up okay? Because litigation is incredibly draining for anyone who's been involved in it. You kind of is the toxins out of the system now? You're sleeping better and
I mean, the whole thing from where to go was sort of like basically 2 years. It's still not quite wrapped up yet. Look, it totally made mincemeat out of my life. It damaged my kids, my husband. You know, I've been through a lot in my life, and this was the first time ever that I withdrew so much that I didn't speak to my own friends or my own children or my own husband. Like, I totally withdrew just to cope. And I don't regret it. I want child safeguards put back in the law, and I will not stop until it's done. There is no cost I will not pay. That's it.
It seems like such a reasonable position to me. Look, Moira, I really appreciate all you do. I know you, despite the personal toll it's taken on you, you've gained a lot of fans, both Australia and internationally, and we all support you in the background. And so if people want to support you or get involved in party politics or support you in the Werribee by-election that's just coming up, what's the best way for them to do that?
I really do think that, joining the Liberal Party is important. It is so important to help steer the ship that is the Liberal Party. You look at Trump, he didn't start a new party. He's taken over and he's steering that party, and he's brought a really big tent of people who are centre-right. I mean, of course, they're going to get called names. Look what happened to Elon Musk when he was doing, like, I love you all. The same old Nazi issue, it's so ridiculous. You know, and it's bad enough coming from them, but we cannot resort to their tactics on our side. Yeah. And it is going to feel like the most common complaint I get is, well, we're just so disappointed in the Liberal Party. Why would we join the Liberal Party? Look what they did to you, Moira. Look what they did. And my answer is, you have to put your feelings aside and you have to be reasonable. You have to come in and you have to help. You have to convince them, through your honourable behaviour, through your contributions to the party. You have to show them that reasonable people believe these things, that you're part of the team, and take up space. Whinging at home isn't going to do anything. Marching in the streets with a sign, like, I'm actually not a big protester, to be brutally honest. It's so ironic, but I actually hate crowds. Like, it must have been so important for me to go to a rally. I don't like rallies. I hate them. No. I find it completely overwhelming.
They're like chanting on the same line over and over. I understand.
Yeah, and so I actually prefer to do the work in the background, and it's really effective. Mm. It's far more effective. I will say that. Like, rallies are, I think they're ineffective. I think what's effective is getting involved, taking up space, and speaking to your friends, like getting educated on topics and talking to your friends and just being calm. The most effective thing that that I've ever done is just never overreacting to people having the wrong idea about me. As much as I just took my leader, to court, I mean, that was just proper defamation. I was not going to be able to feed my children. It's a totally different issue, it's going to be a little bit more.
Politics isn't beanbag, but you can't slander someone. That's the difference.
No, especially with something that's actually going to remove my ability to pay off my mortgage. Like, I was never going to teach him. I mean, all he had to do was say he was not correct, but whatever, it matters. It really matters if you have a big impact. And, we've got to support the MPs that are doing what we want them to do. And the only way you can do that is by joining the party and making sure that you keep on voting for them to keep their positions. And that's not me stacking anybody. That is how our poll works. You want volunteers. You have to let them be members,
Yeah, you do. Hey, I appreciate what you do. Thanks for making time, Moira, and good luck with all the elections and other work that you have ahead of you.
Thank you. Yeah. See you. Thanks. Bye.